NTSB says an airliner crew tried to fly coast to coast on battery power. Hundreds of FA-18 Hornets are grounded for fatigue checks. And the Expedition 17 crew is back safely on Earth. This is Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for downloading this AeroCast. Here's what's up in aviation for Monday, October 27th, 2008. The National Transportation Safety Board has issued a preliminary report on the emergency landing of an American Airlines Boeing 757 at Chicago O'Hare International Airport on September 22nd. The plane overran the runway and veered off into a grassy area to avoid obstructions. Nobody on board was injured. It's going to be some time before the board issues its final report, but there's enough in the prelim to raise eyebrows over the decision-making of the flight crew. American Flight 268 departed Seattle-Tacoma International for New York JFK at about 8 p.m. Pacific time. NTSB investigators say a relay failed, requiring the crew to switch to battery power, which is only rated to provide 30 minutes reserve. But instead of landing at the earliest opportunity, the decision was made to continue the flight with some systems shut down to conserve power. Well, that decision didn't work out so well. An hour and 40 minutes into the flight over western Michigan, cockpit electrical systems began to fail. The board says after the pilot decided to divert to O'Hare, the flight attendants found the PA system and phones didn't work. So notes were passed under the cockpit door to communicate with the flight crew, and passengers were notified of the diversion by flight attendants walking up and down the aisle. The captain declared an emergency, which is fortunate. NTSB says the elevator and standby elevator trim did not respond. The touchdown was smooth, despite control issues, but the thrust reversers and spoilers did not deploy, and the brakes performed poorly. Due to obstructions off the end of the runway, the captain elected to veer left into the grass. Then, when the engines wouldn't shut down normally, the crew had to fire the hail-on-fire system to stop them. The NTSB has reserved commenting further until its final report. Others are not so shy. Michael Barr, an instructor at the University of Southern California's Aviation Safety and Security Program, told USA Today, quote, "They should have landed as soon as practical. I don't see why they thought they could fly all the way across country on their backup electrical system," unquote. So far, there's been no comment from American Airlines or the Allied Pilots Association. More aging U.S. military aircraft are under investigation for possible airframe fatigue issues. Inspections have been ordered for all U.S. Navy and Marine Corps FA-18 Hornets after stress cracks were found in aileron hinges on at least 15 planes. Navy spokesman Lieutenant Clay Doss commented on Thursday's bulletin, which affects 636 A through D models, requiring inspections within their next 15 flight hours. Quote, "Those aircraft that do not pass inspection criteria will be grounded or flight restricted until failed material is replaced," unquote. Doss said priority will be given to the 112 deployed aircraft to reduce the impact on current missions. Inspections will involve non-destructive testing and are expected to be complete within 2 weeks. Boeing is working with the Navy to assess the problem and determine how repairs might be made. Commander Sergei Volkov and flight engineer Oleg Kononenko of the 17th International Space Station crew landed safely on the steps of Kazakhstan at 11:37 p.m. Eastern Time Thursday after more than 6 months in space. With them was tauronaut Richard Garriott, who rode with the Expedition 18 crew to the International Space Station on October 12th. Volkov and Kononenko had spent 199 days in space, 197 of them on the station. All three were reported in good condition after their re-entry and landing in a Soyuz capsule. That's a contrast to the Soyuz TMA-11 that brought home the Expedition 16 crew in April. That capsule failed to properly separate from an equipment module, resulting in a steep, fast, hot, high-G re-entry, followed by a hard landing hundreds of miles off course. U.S. astronaut Peggy Whitson, Russian cosmonaut Yuri Melenchenko, and South Korean tauronaut Yi Soo-yeon survived the harsh conditions, although Yi was hospitalized days after the accident for neck and back pain. U.S. Air Force Secretary Michael Donnelly says the service will stand up a new major command specifically to manage its nuclear assets. The new command will include thousands of airmen and all of the Air Force's domestic nuclear capabilities. The changes come in response to what Donnelly calls painful lessons learned during a series of major blunders involving the Air Force's nuclear program. The new Global Strike Command will include both the 8th and 20th Air Force, An additional squadron of B-52s, mandated by Congress, also will fall within that new command. The change leaves Air Force B-1 Lancer bombers with Air Combat Command. It also moves the cyber and intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance responsibilities out of the 8th Air Force. Air Force Chief of Staff General Norman Schwartz commented, quote, "It was our conclusion that a major command that did space, cyber, and nuclear perhaps was too much for a single organization to address with the necessary focus," unquote. Management of nuclear-capable aircraft assigned to Europe will not fall under the new command. Up next on ANN, Armadillo Aerospace finally collects a prize in the Lunar Lander Challenge. Armadillo and Rocket Racing will collaborate on private space travel. And Lockheed says the F-35 has completed testing at Edwards. You're listening to Aero News.
Diamond Aircraft's new DA-40 Diamond Star XL includes all popular Diamond options, combined with the sensational new Garmin GFC-700 Autopilot, a higher performance power plant, and increased gross weight. This makes the Diamond Star XL the perfect choice for affordable personal flying. The Diamond Star XL features equipment and enhancements that increase performance, capability, safety, convenience, and comfort. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3020.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft merges the most advanced technologies from the fields of hearing science, aviation communications, and performance audio. Clarity Aloft headsets use Comply Canal tips composed of soft, viscoelastic foam, the same foam tips used in advanced hearing aids. The noise-canceling microphone is optimized for speech frequencies in high-noise environments. The low-profile headband is featherweight and comfortable. Just three reasons why you need to feel and hear the difference a Clarity Aloft stereo headset can make for you. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headsets on the web at clarityaloft.com.
We're back with more of your Aero Briefing for October 27th. I'm Paul Plagg. If the folks at Armadillo Aerospace are all walking around with big smiles today, it's not just because they won a prize at the X Games this weekend. On Friday, Armadillo, Rocket Racing, and the state of New Mexico announced a joint venture to send adventurers into suborbital space with a target price of $100,000 or less per seat. The three intend to develop a fleet of reusable vertical takeoff and landing vehicles that will fly from Spaceport America near Las Cruces, New Mexico. Passengers will float weightless with a 360-degree view of space. Competitor Virgin Galactic has proposed suborbital tickets at $200,000 each, providing travelers with only porthole-sized windows. Under the terms of the partnership, Armadillo will develop the reusable launch vehicles and provide ground support and equipment. The state of New Mexico will supply launch facility infrastructure and resources. Rocket Racing Technology Development, a wholly owned subsidiary of Rocket Racing Incorporated, will provide financing and business and operational management. Reservations, experience marketing, and customer training will be managed by an additional partner to be announced later. The parties have set an aggressive schedule, which includes an initial manned vehicle prototype in 2009 and manned flights to space in 2010. Of course, the other big reason for smiles at Armadillo Aerospace also happened on Friday. The Northrop Grumman Lunar Lander Challenge has finally had to spend some of NASA's Centennial Challenges prize money. Armadillo won the Level 1 Challenge at this past weekend's competition in Las Cruces. The Level 1 Challenge required competing spacecraft to lift off and climb vertically 50 meters, then translate 100 meters horizontally, then make a controlled vertical descent to land on a second pad, with a required minimum duration of 90 seconds for the entire flight, and a return flight to the original launch pad within 2.5 hours. Last year, Armadillo had an engine shutdown commanded by an onboard computer 7 seconds before reaching the goal. In 2006, it failed when a landing gear leg broke. But the Las Cruces Sun News reports that on Friday, the upstart commercial spacecraft developer completed both flights required to win $350,000. A later attempt at the Level 2 challenge, which doubles the hover time minimum and adds a requirement to land on an uneven simulated lunar surface, was unsuccessful. That left an additional $1.65 million in prize money unclaimed for the third year in a row. After the event, Armadillo team leader John Carmack told reporters, quote, "It's great that we won the Level 1, but we're going to keep working towards Level 2, which we can hopefully compete for again soon. We know exactly what we need to nail down, and we expect to have it solved in the next couple of weeks," unquote. NASA is funding the competition to spur development of private space vehicles that can land instruments on the moon's surface. Lockheed Martin reports its F-35 Lightning II fighter has finished all planned testing at California's Edwards Air Force Base. Doug Pearson, VP of the F-35 Integrated Test Force for Lockheed, commented, quote, "The exceptional performance of the aircraft and those supporting it shows that the team is ready for the fast-paced flight test activities upcoming at Edwards and Patuxent River, Maryland," unquote. The company says that by the end of 2009, all 19 F-35 test aircraft will be complete and flight test activities will intensify, leading to initial operational test and evaluation in 2013 or 14. During 3 weeks of testing at Edwards, activity centered on validation of the aircraft's ability to shut down and restart its engine in flight. Engineers are pleased with the Pratt & Whitney F-135 turbofan, which they say repeatedly restarted on command. The F-35 involved in the testing is a conventional takeoff and landing variant that has completed 63 flights. Test pilot Jeff Knowles will fly the plane back to Lockheed Martin's plant in Fort Worth, Texas, sometime this week. To LAX locals, it probably looked like any other 777 passing overhead. But this particular plane marked the debut yesterday of Emirates Sky Cargo's thrice-weekly nonstop between Dubai and Los Angeles. The Boeing 777-200LR will carry up to 10 tons of cargo in each direction. The Los Angeles to Dubai outbound service will be welcomed by American fruit and vegetable exporters. Their produce is expected to account for the majority of the cargo shipment, along with U.S. Postal Service mail. Inbound from Dubai to Los Angeles, the main cargo will be textiles from the Indian subcontinent, courier mail, and equipment for the Hollywood film industry. If shipping fresh produce through a hub in the Middle East sounds risky, well, it is. Emirates Sky Cargo has developed a patent-pending white cover to protect pallets of perishable foods and pharmaceuticals from the heat. It also has specialized insulated aluminum containers on steel trailers for moving them from the plane to its new 7,000-square-meter refrigerated area in Dubai's new mega terminal. Emirates Sky Cargo's global network includes 101 cities in 61 countries across the Americas, Europe, Asia-Pacific, Middle East, Africa, and the Indian subcontinent. U.S. nonstop service started with New York in 2004 and now includes Toledo and Houston, and the company plans to launch service to San Francisco by the end of the year. Still ahead, Lancair owners now have a type club. A developer is working on a single-place suborbital space vehicle. And introducing the $6 glass panel. You're listening to AeroNews.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways. And you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
We're back to wrap up your Aero Briefing for Monday, October 27th. I'm Paul Platt. Lancair enthusiasts now have a new resource. LOBO stands for Lancair Owners and Builders Organization, formed by owners and builders who believe their community faces major challenges best met by a single, unified voice. LOBO was co-founded by Jeff Edwards, Robert Petusik, Claudette Colwell, John Halley, and former ANN staffer Mark Sletten. The mission statement reads thus, quote, "The Lancair Owners and Builders Organization promotes the safe use and enjoyment of Lancair aircraft through education, training, and fellowship. Additionally, LOBO safeguards and furthers its members' interests with regulatory agencies, the general aviation community, and the public at large," unquote. The group claims LOBO has been endorsed by Joe Bartels, owner of Lancair International Incorporated, and received an enthusiastic reaction from the majority of attendees at the annual factory-sponsored Lancair fly-in at Hot Springs, Arkansas. Find out more about the group at www.lancairowners.com. This next story is about a new manned spacecraft being developed for private suborbital flight, and it's different from what's gone before in just about any way you could imagine. The developer is Copenhagen Suborbitals. All joking about a pinch between the cheek and gum aside, this thing is small. It's envisioned as holding one person with only enough room to move his arms, just enough to reach the barf bag, and maybe turn his head a little bit, but with a polymer plexiglass dome to fully appreciate the view. The MicroSci spacecraft, or MSC, will be launched atop a rocket fueled by epoxy and liquid oxygen. Every good space program needs lots of acronyms, and this rocket is called HEAT, short for Hybrid Exo-Atmospheric Transporter. The rocket is sized for a 60-second burn, which does not exceed 3 Gs at any point along its route. That's for passenger comfort. Ironically, HEAT will be launched from Iceland. There won't be much instruction required for passengers to operate the controls. See, there aren't any. The developers say the craft is purely ballistic. Quote, "We don't use any attitude controllers or mechanical guidance on our boosters. The system is very basic and will rely completely on the laws of aerodynamics," unquote. Be sure to offer a generous tip to the guy who aims it for you. The craft is going to land using a 2-stage automated parachute system with a personal chute built into the seat in case you have to bail out. Copenhagen Suborbitals reports the successful test firing of a 1/3 scale booster on October 19th. The company insists the single-seat craft is for peaceful purposes only and is being designed to carry a 24-hour duration life support system, but not to be capable of carrying explosive, nuclear, biological, or chemical payloads. The Australian Research Center for Aerospace Automation 2008 UAV Outback Rescue Challenge was held last month in Queensland. Teams were required to use unmanned aerial vehicles in a simulated search for Outback Joe, stranded in the Australian outback and desperately in need of assistance. Official rules published by ARCAA allow just an hour of time for setup, launch, mission, landing, and recovery. The event was held at Kingaroy Airport, the site for a new UAV test and training center being used by Boeing Australia and ARCAA. The competition drew two well-funded university teams staffed by aerospace engineers and one other entry, two hobbyists flying a 30-year-old Hobby Lobby Telemaster high-wing RC model kit purchased more than 30 years ago by the father of one of the contestants. You want to guess where this one's going? The search area was defined as a 2x2 nautical mile square, which could be up to 5 nautical miles from the airport. The target was a person or dummy dressed in light khaki clothes, not moving, lying down, in a rural setting. The goal was to locate Joe, drop him 500 milliliters of water, return to Kingaroy, and land. Well, both university teams crashed during the mission. Aaron Donaldson and Simeon O'Neill were awarded the $5,000 prize, even though their plane was forced down by a bad electrical connector. The Telemaster was originally designed to be powered by a traditional glow plug 2-stroke, but this particular one was adapted for electric power. It also carried a fully articulated belly cam. The ground control system displayed airspeed, altimeter, artificial horizon, the plane's GPS coordinates, and included an autopilot system and a video screen. Both university-sponsored teams were estimated to have spent 4 times as much on their projects as Team Telemaster. Donaldson observed, quote, "Everyone was aerospace engineers. Simeon and I didn't finish more than a semester of engineering," unquote. Hobby Lobby International is a 43-year-old company based in Tennessee that manufactures RC airplanes, helicopters, and boats. The company is understandably delighted to get word on the success of its 3-decades-old balsa wood kit. And finally, as soon as they started building mobile electronic devices with built-in accelerometer chips, you knew this one had to happen. Announcing iHood, a $6 download that turns your iPod into a glass panel. Well, almost. AeroVisions International says its product turns the iPhone into, quote, "an aerospace-inspired mobile glass cockpit," unquote. The company warns that the application is merely for entertainment purposes and is, quote, "not intended for steering airplanes, helicopters, boats, motorcycles, and other powered vehicles, and UFOs," unquote. But it sure looks the part. Simulated horizon, vehicle reference symbol, dynamic speed, altitude, vertical velocity ribbons, and digital display window, rotating compass card with user-selectable heading bug, slip skid ball, and even a G-meter. The company does suggest it could be a learning tool. Quote, "iHood offers a fantastic way to teach, see, and learn EFIS and partially AHRS on the fly," unquote. So, aside from a larger display and type certification, why would anyone pay 5,000 times more for a Garmin G600? Well, sadly, there's a significant limitation to iHood. Horizon information is calculated only from the accelerometers inside the iPhone. AeroVision warns, quote, "This means that the horizon does not display the Earth horizon as a reference of a vehicle in an accelerated attitude. Therefore, never use this version of iHood for in-flight operations," unquote. If you notice those words, "this version," in the disclaimer, and it has you on the edge of your seat, well, you may be justified. The company adds, quote, "We are currently studying the possibility to mathematically model an algorithm to address this issue," unquote. If you have a dark sense of humor, you may want to start an office pool on when the first iPhone glass panel makes its appearance in an NTSB report. You know it's going to happen. That's the latest from Aero News. Remember to check out the ANN special feature. Today, in my weekly chat with CFI Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, we'll discuss two recent fatal accidents which resulted in part from choices many general aviation pilots have made. And if you haven't done it yet, subscribe to our AeroCasts. Find them on iTunes, Yahoo, Odeo, and at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.